From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Kale. It's a vegetable touted for its cholesterol-lowering properties, but actually it may pose a risk when it's contaminated with a heavy metal. We'll get the latest on kale, as well as coconut oil, coffee, and the MIND diet for pumping up your brain power.
Also on the program, the FDA recently approved a drug for treating women with low libido. Just who will benefit from this little pink pill? And mineral oil, a home remedy for constipation, has been linked to serious problems in children.
All that, along with this week's health and medical news, right after this. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Kale.
Yum!
Heard about it, yeah. Touted as one of the world's healthiest vegetables. You know, it's high on the list of foods for people who want to lower their cholesterol and presumably reduce the risk of getting cancer. But recently, kale has been linked to some undesirable side effects.
The dark side of kale.
Mm-hmm. Things like chronic fatigue, skin and hair problems, and certain neurological issues.
Here to talk about the latest on kale, as well as some other nutrition-related topics that we've been saving up for him, is Dr. Donald Hensrud. Dr. Hensrud is a specialist in internal and preventative medicine at Mayo Clinic. He is also editor-in-chief of the Mayo Clinic Diet, as well as several other books on diet and healthy eating. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Hensrud.
Happy to be here, Tracy and Dr. Shives.
Donald, nice to have you. So a lot of people cuckoo for kale. What's the big deal?
Well, kale is a very nutritious food. It is very low in calories, so it's low in calorie density, but it's very high in many different nutrients, so high in nutrient density. So you can get a big bang for your buck, so to speak, when you're eating kale. It's high in a couple of carotenoid compounds, lutein and zeaxanthin, that have been linked with macular degeneration and cataracts. It's high in vitamin C, vitamin K, a little bit of calcium, little protein, little fiber. It's got a little bit of everything in there. So that's why it's been one of the, quote, superfoods in recent years.
So where's it been all our life?
It's been around. It's been around the world. It's served in many different countries in various ways. And these things kind of go in cycles. You've all heard about, you know, the foods come and go. And kale's been at the top of the list in recent years. I think it's important to keep in mind there are a lot of other great foods, too. It's in the same family as broccoli and cauliflower, and those have beneficial effects on cancer also. So it's not that it's, you know, the be-all, end-all, but it's one of the more nutritious foods that we can eat, if you like it. You have to be practical and enjoy your food,
oh,
too.
Oh, you just have to find a way to like it. That's what it's all about. Okay, so
put
what's
enough
the
butter on there. Salt and
saute
pepper,
it with a little olive oil. Yeah. Okay, but what's the problem? Too much of it must be the problem.
Well, a couple of things. It's been linked with possible thyroid issues. That hasn't really panned out so much. And this business about thallium, this comes from a report, not a scientific report, but a report of a practitioner on the West Coast who noticed that some of his patients were having a lot of symptoms and linked it to this thallium that kale takes up. It is true that kale does take up a little bit of thallium. I don't think we've really vetted these reports, though, scientifically yet. There's some possible associations there, and whether it pans out once it goes under the rigor of scientific confirmation, I think then we'll know a little bit more.
You tasted kale?
I drink kale. I drink kale, yes, in
kale
green
juice.
Smoothies, and I had some for lunch yesterday. I chop it up and some quinoa, and I made a bowl out of it, Tom, with some beets. It was wonderful.
Now check her cholesterol.
All right, let's talk about...
One thing about kale and smoothies, when you freeze it, it gets a little sweet, and so people enjoy that also, and it makes some pretty good chips, too.
Yeah, that one I'm working on. I can't get the recipe quite right, so I just stick with the smoothies.
Is there some areas in the country where you can grow kale where there is no thallium in the soil, if you're concerned about that?
Good question. I don't know the answer to that. I assume most places do not have a large amount of thallium in the soil. It's just some idiosyncratic thing that in this area there happens to be some.
And most plants that grow most fruits and vegetables don't take up thallium? Is that it?
Most don't. Kale and some others do. And that's where the issue
comes
in. Not
to worry.
Not to worry.
Little thallium never hurt anybody.
I'm a little more worried about coffee because I like it. I pay very close attention when the studies come in that say coffee is good for you. But the last one that I heard is like, maybe you're drinking too much coffee. and I get a little nervous about my coffee being taken away from me.
Again, I think, you know, with like a lot of things, we go back and forth on this. It's good, it's bad, and the truth usually lies somewhere in between. If you look at the total body of literature on coffee, it does seem to have some pretty good health benefits. Decreased risk of type 2 diabetes in a number of studies, decreased risk of liver disease, liver cancer, protection against Parkinson's disease, possibly dementia. So the list goes on and on. It's a stimulant, as we all know. It decreases reaction time, so you react faster. Improves mood, cognition, decreased risk of depression. So there's quite a long list. From a health standpoint, coffee in general is much more healthy than the risks associated. The problem with coffee is the side effects. And some people are more susceptible than the side effects to the side effects than others. We metabolize it on a genetic basis. So some people metabolize caffeine quickly.
Oh, really?
Other people slowly. And that explains my wife can have a cup of coffee and go to sleep. And if I have one in the afternoon, I'm up all night. I'm more susceptible to it. Other side effects, heartburn for some people, palpitations, too much can cause people to become nervous and irritable. So if you suffer from the side effects, then it's time to back off. But overall, it's a relatively healthy drink for those people who don't have a lot of side effects.
All right, the gluten-free craze. You go to the grocery store, and half of what you see is gluten-free. Now, it's like half the population has celiac disease, and we know that's not the case. So what is the deal with gluten-free foods?
So if you really look at the data, less than up to 1% of people in this country and around the world have celiac disease.
Meaning they can't metabolize gluten.
It's an immune condition, and they really need to avoid gluten because they will suffer nutritional and other health effects from gluten.
One out of 100.
There may be a couple percent or so, we don't know the exact amount, who have gluten sensitivity. That means they get symptoms from gluten, such as bloating, diarrhea. People describe a brain fog. That may be a couple percent of people. So there's a small percentage of people, either with celiac or gluten sensitivity, that probably shouldn't have it. They feel better. There's a whole bunch of people who are avoiding gluten for health reasons, and that is misguided. If you look at the data on whole grains, they're associated with a reduced risk of heart disease, some cancers. And so in general, whole grains that contain gluten are beneficial, providing you don't have celiac disease or gluten sensitivity. So the whole marketing thing, 20 to 25% of people avoiding gluten for health reasons, they should reconsider and enjoy some whole wheat pasta, whole wheat bread, and other foods that contain gluten.
All right. I'm glad you cleared that up.
We have a question from someone who's watching us on Periscope right now, and they want to know about overall reducing your carbs. So overall carb reduction in hopes that it will help with people who have problems with inflammation.
Yeah, good question. You know, and again, looking at the big picture, we've gone back and forth. Years ago, if everybody was trying to eat a low-fat, high-carb diet, then we turned it on its end. Everybody was eating a high-fat, low-carb diet. And now gluten's the bad guy, so we're into protein these days. In terms of carbs and inflammation, there's some data, mostly test tube data, in vitro data, about inflammation and carbohydrate. This became popular through a book called Grain Brain. I think it takes it a little bit too far. It's true that there may be some low, very low levels of inflammation. Whether that actually contributes to disease or not hasn't been conclusively shown. And what we recommend here at Mayo in terms of carbs and fat, you don't have to go very low carb or very low fat. Just try and avoid less healthy carbs and less healthy fats. So cut down on simple sugars. Absolutely. We eat far too many simple sugars, and that may be reflected in the dietary guidelines that are coming out later this year. Try and avoid processed flour. Eat more whole grains, and that can you can still get some carbs and keep your inflammation level low if you want to.
You had mentioned referencing coffee. You know, you and your wife metabolize coffee differently. Would there be something to the comment that people would metabolize their carbohydrates differently? Could there be something to that? Has that been studied?
Well, people do metabolize different carbohydrates differently. Lactose intolerance, for example. Mm-hmm. Lactose is a simple sugar, And some people have lactase deficiency or lactose intolerance, and they metabolize it differently. But in general, there's nothing, I don't think we need to avoid carbs altogether. Just stick with the healthier carbs.
All right, we're about out of time. What about the coconut craze and coconut water? Anything?
Well, so coconut is a saturated, it mainly contains saturated fat, about 90% of it. Lauric acid is a medium chain saturated fat, which is high in coconuts, and it doesn't seem to raise LDL or bad cholesterol as much as long chain fatty acids. So that's true. It doesn't affect cholesterol as much as what we thought. And it has good taste and texture and everything. But boy, the things I'm seeing about coconut, it can cure everything from cancer to Alzheimer's. And I think people are going out on a limb on that one.
So it's okay, but you wouldn't pay up for it.
No.
It's delicious, Tom. Delicious. We're talking with Mayo Clinic nutrition and healthy eating specialist, Dr. Donald Hensrud. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, myth or matter of fact, the MIND diet combines the best of two diets that help to improve brain power.
MIND. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest health and nutrition expert, Dr. Donald Hensrud. He is also editor-in-chief of the Mayo Clinic Diet Book. There are so many of them out there, including the Mayo Clinic Diet, and they seem to all be fads to a certain degree. Yours is really a lifestyle change more than it is a diet. But now the popular one is the MIND, the M-I-N-D diet.
Myth or matter of fact, does it combine the best of two diets to improve brain power?
That's a fact.
Okay.
It does. So people have been looking at how diet can affect the risk of dementia for a long time. We know, for example, that physical activity is one of the most powerful things that people can do to preserve cognition and decrease the risk of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. In terms of diet, people have looked at different things, and there's some evidence with different foods. So what these researchers did, they took two different diets. One is the traditional Mediterranean diet. Mainly they looked at the Greek version, and there are different Mediterranean diets too, depending on where in the Mediterranean you go. And they looked at the DASH diet. The DASH diet has been around for a long time. It was originally designed for high blood pressure, been studied a lot, and does seem to have some beneficial effects, not only on high blood pressure, but other things. So they combined these two diets, and they took 900 people. They followed them for a number of years. They asked them, which of these foods do you eat? And they looked at the foods that were associated with the least amount of cognitive decline. In other words, people who are eating certain foods, their cognition, their mind power declined faster than people who were eating other more beneficial foods. To some extent, this is kind of, you know, we tend to label diets, and there are common foods in all these diets that are good. No surprise, vegetables, fruits, fish, olive oil, whole grains, chicken and poultry, even a little bit of wine and beans. They took a couple of food categories and took them one step farther. In vegetables, leafy greens seem to be very beneficial, such as kale.
There's
and others.
That kale again.
That's right. Nutrition powerhouses and not a lot of calories. And among fruits, berries seem to do the best. We've known that berries are high in antioxidants for quite some time. Blueberries received all the attention, but they're all good. Blackberries, raspberries, strawberries, they're all high in antioxidants. Those types of foods seem to be associated with less cognitive decline. Foods that were associated with faster cognitive decline, and there's really no surprise here, red meat, butter and margarine, pastries and sweets, fried and fast foods. So we tend to label things, but if we look at just kind of what are the more beneficial foods in general, this is on the foods I mentioned earlier are on many of the lists.
But what does DASH stand for?
Dietary approaches to stop hypertension. That diet consists of 8 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, but a serving isn't that big. It's a half cup of broccoli. I could eat that in 3 bites. Mm-hmm. Whole grains, fish, a little olive oil, a little nuts, and not a lot of animal products, meat and high-fat dairy products.
But, you know, this is basically the same message that you've been bringing to the table for years. So it's not so much a problem of knowing what we should eat. It's a problem of actually doing it. How do you work on that problem?
You're exactly right, Tom. You know, we tend to label things, and there are certain foods, a plant-based diet that emerges as beneficial for health in a number of different ways. Applying that in our lives can be challenging, but it's not impossible. Many people say that when I was eating better, I felt better, or when I weighed a little bit less. They need to listen to that. And it doesn't have to be impossible in our busy lives either. There are quick and healthy things. People can keep different foods on the pantry to go for if they don't have a lot of time. Even eating out in fast foods. There are different sandwiches that people can choose, throw on a lot of vegetables and things like that. There are a lot of things we can do in our busy lives to make a difference in the way we're eating.
I want to ask you, we're all concerned about dementia, Alzheimer's disease, and partly because we're living longer. How about your favorite brain foods?
I like leafy greens for a lot of things.
Kale?
Kale, whatever you like, spinach. I like arugula myself. I love the spiciness of it. And vegetables, not only for brain food, but because they have so many beneficial effects on heart disease, cancer. They're nutrient powerhouses. Fish has been associated with a little bit of cognitive preservation. Nuts are good. Berries.
Yeah, what nuts should we be eating?
Good question. The ones you like.
Okay, so any of them are good.
Every nut has a different nutrient profile. Mm-hmm. Brazil nuts are high in selenium and high in magnesium. Pistachios are high in potassium. So if you eat mixed nuts, you get the benefits of all their beneficial nutrient profiles.
Gotcha.
I just hope I can remember what he said.
I hope so too. Now, you mentioned a little while ago about the new dietary guidelines. Those are changing this year?
Every 5 years, the government comes out with new dietary guidelines. And this, like a lot of nutrition, should be looked at as evolutionary and not revolutionary. So it's not going to change dramatically from 5 years to 5 years, but they refine the message. Some things that they're emphasizing this year, one is no surprise, decreased sugar intake. They're taking a stronger stance on that. The American Heart Association did a few years ago. And sugar, to me, this is a no-brainer. It's a quadruple whammy, meaning there are four negative things regarding sugar in our diet, added sugars, not sugars in fruit. Number one, it's empty calories. It adds a lot of calories. Number two, there's no nutritional value. Unlike kale, that has a lot of different micronutrients, sugar has no micronutrients, and you need nutrients to help digest the carbohydrate. Number three, if you're drinking soda, for example, with sugar, you're not drinking something else that's probably healthier. And number four, there is some evidence, as we talked about earlier, that sugar has a mild toxic effect in terms of inflammation. So there's a number of reasons to decrease our sugar intake, and the dietary guidelines are going to come out stronger on that. Another issue is they're going to emphasize less red meat and processed meat for the first time, at least in the draft of it, that's associated with colon cancer, heart disease. So it doesn't mean everybody has to become a vegetarian, but in general, for the health benefits, decreasing that. And finally, the last thing that may not make it into the guidelines is a little controversial. They talked about a sustainable food supply, and Congress said, stay out of that area.
Interesting.
They put it in anyway, that we need to look at sustainable food supply. Whether that goes into the final version or not remains to be seen.
What do you mean sustainable food supply?
Think about the environment. So fish, for example, don't fish out different species of fish and go green with the environment in terms of thinking about the environment and not just depleting the soil and not worrying about the consequences of some of the things we're doing with our foods.
Thanks very much, Dr. Hensrud, for bringing us up to date on a variety of diet and nutrition topics. Dr. Donald Hensrud is a specialist in internal and preventive medicine at Mayo Clinic. He's also editor-in-chief of the Mayo Clinic Diet.
Thanks, Dr. Hensrud.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, the FDA recently approved a new drug for women with low libido problems. We'll get the details on that new drug and on a new study that links everyday mindfulness with improving sexual health.
And the risks of using mineral oil to relieve constipation, especially in young children.
You have a health-related question you'd like us to answer or a topic you'd like us to cover? You can tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or send us an email at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu. Coming up, the latest health and medical news from Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
What's the skinny on saturated and trans fats? I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. Saturated fats come from animal products like dairy and meat, and Canadian researchers found they are okay in moderation for most healthy people. Trans fats are mostly manufactured and called partially hydrogenated fats, but are associated with an increased risk of death. So the type of fat you eat may really matter. And let's talk about making sure our kids eat right as they head back to school.
having good nutrition could lead to good academic outcomes for children.
Mayo Clinic Dr. Brian Lynch says try to steer clear of highly processed foods and push whole grains, lean meats, and fruits and veggies. So what if your kid wants a sugar-sweetened drink? Well, research in the journal BMJ shows drinking them regularly is associated with increased risk of type 2 diabetes. For more health and medical news, visit the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Well, after twice rejecting it, the Food and Drug Administration last month approved filgrastim, the little pink pill. And it presumably will enhance the sexual drive in women with low libido. The drug has been dubbed by some as female Viagra.
Well, that helps us to describe what it's for, doesn't it? Here to talk about the newly approved drug and about a new study of how to improve sexual health is Dr. Jordan Rulo. Dr. Rulo is a clinical psychologist and certified sex therapist at the Women's Health Clinic at Mayo Clinic here in Rochester, Minnesota. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Rulo.
Thank you for having me.
Well, they finally approved this drug, which has been anticipated by a lot of people, probably more men than women.
Oh, wait. But it was denied two times previously by the FDA?
Exactly. What's the problem and why did they finally approve it?
Oh, that's a big question. The main problem, I think the reason why the FDA was having difficulty approving it is all the side effects. And there was a lot of argument that it didn't work much better than placebo. So placebo is just giving a woman a sugar pill and saying, see how this impacts your desire, versus giving them this medication that has a bunch of side effects and saying, see how this impacts your desire. So there's a few ways they measured this medication to see, is this better than just a sugar pill?
So, or a glass of wine.
Or a glass of wine. That's
which
right.
You cannot have if you're taking this medication, by the way.
It makes you sick.
You take this medication,
you can't drink.
You cannot drink. And this, unlike, well, okay, there's so many things to say about this. So let me just back up a little bit more. So people are calling it the female Viagra because that's an easy way to think about it. But Viagra is really for arousal. Viagra is about bringing blood flow to the genitals. Mm-hmm. This pill,
it's not about desire at all.
Exactly.
It's so, about performance.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Except for this pill, Addy or flibanserin, is about desire. So it's not about performance. It's about desire, your want to be sexual. So unlike Viagra, which is take it when you need it, the day of, hour before, this pill is take it every day at night before you go to bed. So this is an everyday pill, which means that as long as you are on this, you cannot be drinking alcohol, which is funny because we know that alcohol actually does help with desire.
That's what I said. And the difference between that placebo and the flibanserin was 4.4 times per month versus 3.7 times per month for the women who were on placebo.
Right. So they measured it. So one of the ways they measured this drug compared to the sugar pill, the placebo, was sexually satisfying events. So they predicted if you're on this pill, you should have many more sexually satisfying events on this pill versus being on the sugar pill. But what they found is that women reported just about one more sexually satisfying event per month. And that was one of the big things the FDA was getting hung up on. Is one more sexually satisfying event worth all the potential side effects you're going to have to deal with when being on this medication? But there are really two other ways that they measured this pill as well. And they added these measures later on in their trial. But the two other ways they measured it, two questionnaires. So one asked about just the woman's self-report of her desire. So how much desire does she feel? And then the second one was her self-report of how distressed she is about her sexual desire. So how distressed are you and how much desire do you think you have? Totally self-report. And those two measures, the woman reported significantly more desire on the pill versus the sugar pill and significantly less distress on the pill versus the sugar pill. So it's those two measures that really, I think, give flibanserin some extra boost to say, okay, this may be an effective medication.
And maybe.
Maybe.
This may be.
What are some of the other risks?
So there's nausea, dizziness, the alcohol piece is a drop in blood pressure. Those are the main side effects.
And who would, for one half more time.
Less than one time per month.
Take this pill. I don't quite understand.
Well, so that's just the sexually satisfying events, that additional one time per month. But think about if you feel like, I feel like my desire is better and I am less distressed, then maybe you might want to take the pill. Maybe you're not even having any more sex, but you feel better.
Oh, just distress in general, not distress
about sex. Sexual distress. Yeah. Sexual distress.
That you're upset that you, that it's something that's bothering you.
Right. Right. You're less sexually distressed and you feel like your desire is more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting to not look at it as that, the amount of times that the woman has sex, but the distress and the satisfaction that you feel throughout the day. That's interesting.
And researchers are arguing that your self-report of distress and your desire is probably a better measure of this drug than sexually satisfying events, because just like you mentioned before, this drug isn't about performance. If you were measuring performance, you probably would want to count the number of times you're having sex per month. But we're not measuring performance. We're measuring desire. And what's the best measure we have of desire? What a woman says her desire is. Go ahead.
So you're not a big fan of flibanserin?
No. No, not at all. I think that flibanserin is going to be great for a subset of women. So what's interesting is they tested it only on premenopausal women. But we know one of the big concerns with desire is in postmenopausal women. Sure. So my patients who probably need this the most, they're not even eligible for it. Those are postmenopausal women. Mm. So this is for
it's not approved for postmenopausal women.
Nope, it's for premenopausal women because that's who it was tested on. So it's for premenopausal women, and it's specifically designed for women who report that their only concern is low desire. It's nothing about the relationship. It's not that they're too tired. It's not that they're stressed out. It's just, hey, I'm fine. I'm not stressed. Everything's going well. I have time to be sexual. I don't know. I just don't want to be. I don't know why. I see some of those women. It's a very small percentage of women that I see. So I think flibanserin will be great for those women. It's a small percentage.
And I know from speaking with you in the past that I would predict you would say there are other ways to improve your sex life. And that'll bring us to our next topic of discussion.
Yes. Okay, so if we think about desire, it's so much more complex than perhaps just taking a medication for most women. Low desire is caused by a variety of things. There could be biological factors. It could be psychological factors. You're stressed. You're sad. It could be you don't like your partner, so why in the world would you desire to have sex with them? Lots of different factors. One of the main factors that impacts desire is being distracted, being stressed out, not being able to really be present. So over the past 5 or so years, there have been some really neat research studies that have looked at the concept of mindfulness.
Oh, it's like the buzzword.
It is the buzzword, yeah.
Mindfulness.
Mindfulness is helpful for anxiety, depression, pain reduction, a lot of different areas. But we're learning that mindfulness is actually really helpful for women with low desire, women who have difficulty with their sexual arousal, and for women who have orgasm problems. So we have this awesome mindfulness program here at Mayo taught by Dr. Amit Sood called the SMART program, which stands for Stress Management and Resiliency Training. And what's really neat about the SMART program is it teaches mindfulness in everyday little nuggets. So basically you learn mindfulness 7 minutes a day, and you just kind of sprinkle it into your day. And I thought, well, what if we take this SMART program and use it for women's sexual health? So instead of teaching women mindfulness and saying, now you're going to have to go home and you have to do hours of homework and you're going to meditate and you're going to read this and learn mindfulness, and so this will take you several hours a week, what if we just sprinkle this Dr. Sood's SMART program, the 7 minutes a day, just sprinkle it into a woman's life but direct it toward her sexual health? Will that be helpful? So I don't know the answer, but we're doing a research study to look just at this. And this is an online research study. So we're recruiting couples. So specifically, we're recruiting women because what we're looking at is this study going to help their desire, their arousal, the orgasm? So we're recruiting women and their partners. Doesn't matter if their partner's male or female. So women and their partners do this online program. They'll do Dr. Sood's SMART online course, and then they'll do a sexual education mindfulness course that's connected to his SMART course. Anyone can do this except for the woman. The main participant in the study has to come to the Mayo Clinic at least once to fill out informed consent. So it takes about an hour and a half to do all the paperwork to say, yes, I'm willing to be in this study. But after that one visit, go back home, chat with your partner about it, get your partner on board, and then participate in the online program.
How can people get hooked up with you to take part in this study?
Great question. So a couple places they can either call. So we have a research coordinator who will answer the phone, who can tell them more about the study, make sure they're eligible, and walk them through how to do it. So the phone number is 507-266-1944. So they can call or they can email. So the email address is domcro@mayo.edu.
And is this for anyone who wants to improve their sexual health or sexual relationship?
So
it's not for those who are having a problem?
It is for women who are reporting that they are distressed about their desire, their arousal, or their orgasm. So you have to be a woman over the age of 18. You have to have a partner who's willing to do these activities, this online course with you. Doesn't matter how long you've been with that partner. They just have to be willing to do the activities with you. And you have to report that you're distressed in some way with your desire, arousal, or orgasm.
We've been talking with Mayo Clinic psychologist and sex therapist Dr. Jordan Rulo about a new study of the role that everyday mindfulness can play in improving sexual health. Thanks for being on the program. I'm Dr. Rulo.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. We'll take a short break. When we come back, mineral oil has long been used as an over-the-counter treatment for constipation. But using mineral oil to relieve constipation in young children may have serious consequences. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Mineral oil, that clear, thick liquid you get at the drugstore. Well, it's often used as a home remedy for constipation. And take it by mouth, it helps keep water in the stool, and that makes it softer and easier to pass.
Oh, spoken like a true dad. It's been a long time since you've had to worry about potty training, though, right,
Thank
Tom?
Goodness, yes.
Well, mineral oil is not recommended for older adults, people who are confined to a bed, and to children who are younger than 6 years of age.
Well, a recently published study of a five-year-old who developed juvenile idiopathic arthritis, or JRA. That means juvenile, young, idiopathic, meaning we don't know what caused it, and of course you know what arthritis is. Well, they found, this case study, found an association between the arthritis and daily doses of mineral oil. Here to talk about the case study is its author, Dr. Mark Wylam. Dr. Wylam is a specialist in pediatric and adolescent medicine at Mayo Clinic. Dr. Wylam, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about this study. Pretty interesting. What prompted you to study this five-year-old boy?
This case came in the usual sense that there was an arthritis that was unexplained in cause. The rheumatologists who were caring for the child here at Mayo Clinic noticed an abnormality on the chest x-ray. And at that time, it was just a vague abnormality. And the mother then reported that the child did have a cough. So we have two things going on, both unexplained arthritis and cough. We performed a bronchoscopy to sort of understand the nature of the cough.
Now, the bronchoscopy?
That would be a fiber optic exam of the bronchial tubes, if you will.
So you stick a tube down through the throat?
Under anesthesia, okay. And we flush some salt water in and out of the lung to sort of examine for potential germs and other foreign material. We found oil. Surprisingly, it was a surprise to us. And then we went back to the mother, and in more detail, history taking, we learned that ever since near birth, on the recommendation of her mother, that she would keep the child's bowels regular by twice daily administration of mineral oil as a laxative, as you were discussing.
Okay, as you said, how did the mineral oil get in the lung?
Well, oils applied to the upper airway, the mouth, or even the nostrils can inadvertently, when swallowed, slide past the epiglottis into the airway.
Oh, my gosh.
So we call this lipoid pneumonia, lipoid because it's fat or oil. And these can enter into the lung from things as innocuous as vapor rubs, et cetera, applied to the nose for hydration. And I would say we often see that in older folks who have chronic dry nasal passages, and year by year by year, enough oil accumulates to deposit into the lung and cause what looks like a pneumonia or chronic cough condition.
So she was giving just spoonfuls of mineral oil to the child?
I believe it was of the nature of teaspoon twice a day, at least.
Yeah, for presumably to prevent constipation. The child wasn't constipated, were they?
No.
Okay, then explain the arthritis, the juvenile arthritis
in
there.
Now we get into the realm of speculation, but it's an interesting speculation. Since the 1950s, scientists who were developing vaccines would often dissolve bacteria that they wanted to make a vaccine towards in oils and inject it into persons to hope that that would stimulate an immune response, maybe to develop protective immunity against tuberculosis and such. They also found that all sorts of vaccines could have their effect enhanced by oils. But they also found when they eliminated the bacteria parts and just injected the oil that there was also an enhancement of the immune system. So even to this day, some vaccines are fortified, if you will, with traces of oil to stimulate the immune system. And subsequently, we learned that internally ingested into the body, oils can stimulate the immune reactions. More recently, in the last decade, studies have shown that large populations of patients with rheumatoid arthritis, for example, have a higher propensity to have occupational exposures to oil. So there's a quite significant enhanced incidence of rheumatoid arthritis in persons inadvertently ingesting, even through the skin, oils.
Wow, so this kind of arthritis that the five-year-old boy had is somewhat similar to rheumatoid arthritis in that it's an immune system arthritis,
in fact,
a hyperreaction of the immune system.
Its old name was juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And we know that juvenile rheumatoid arthritis and rheumatoid arthritis in adults is some bit dependent on your genetics and some bit dependent on what turns on your immune system when you have those genetics. Now, again, population studies would suggest that mineral oils might be one of those things that turn on a predisposed person. And in this particular case, we had ample exposure. And it isn't all that common to see it with this degree of difficulty in the management of this child. So, again, we can't draw a one-to-one here, but it's quite provoking to think that incidental exposures to oils, particularly when they have second impairments like lipoid pneumonia, an extra reason to avoid them.
So is it a common practice still to this day for parents to use mineral oil to presumably prevent constipation?
Strong recommendation to the contrary. That is to say, we don't recommend it. We have all other alternatives.
But it's fairly common?
It's passed down by generation by generation. So
grandma,
grandmas. I don't want to incriminate all the grandmothers
you said that it was the mother's mother who had done it the same way.
I suspect when we had lesser therapies for constipation, some of the non-absorbable sugars and the like that can pull water in and function more safely, mineral oils were probably part of the armamentarium.
We were talking about at the beginning, my script said that it's not good for people who are confined to bed, so older adults or younger than six. What about that middle time in there? What about from six to when you're elderly? Is that okay?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, this is a little outside my normal zone of practice, but it's easy for me to see during bronchoscopy that we all have a risk for swallowing things, quote, down the wrong way. normally those things are food and salt and liquids. Oils, of course, are propensity to bypass that flapper valve, the epiglottis. And again, I would say that chronic ingestion of oils at any age group would probably promote a potential risk for aspiration into the lung.
You deal with children. Is there ever a reason for a parent to give their child mineral oil for constipation or anything else?
Again, as a practitioner of, let's say, cystic fibrosis, where all of our patients there have a high propensity to constipation and bowel obstruction, we never use mineral oil.
You're not a fan, it doesn't sound like.
Sign me up, yeah. Not a fan.
Anything else that you learned from this case study of this young boy?
Well, one of the things is that oils, when ingested and when they do enter the lung, take a long time to be eliminated from the lung. So we've done follow-up over the years in this child, and the lung does not clear oil very well. It doesn't have a mechanism for clearing oil. The macrophages, which are the cells that engulf the oil, they have a certain lifespan, and when they die, they release the oil, and a new macrophage takes it up. So once in the lung, it's pretty improbable to get a lot of clearance of the oil.
And even if you give it by mouth, there's a chance it's going to end up in the lung.
To my way of thinking.
Tough for the body to get rid of it. And Dr. Mark Wylam, he's a specialist in pediatric and adolescent medicine at Mayo Clinic. Dr. Wylam, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That's our program for this week.
For more information, visit the Mayo Clinic News Network for today's podcast and previously aired programs.
Tweet your health and medicine questions to hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
Some of our guests are recorded during a Periscope session. Get the app for iOS or Android, follow Mayo Clinic, and join us.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Rich Dietman, our social media editor, Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.